Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Tech Doctor Podcast. It's a pleasure to be with you again here. I'm going to play a talk for you that I presented to the Unitarian Church of the Brazos Valley in College Station, Texas, on Sunday, November 25th, 2012. The talk is entitled, An Accessible Life for the Visually Impaired. I cover some autobiographical information as well as discuss Apple accessibility. Hope you enjoy the talk. Today, what I'm going to be talking to you about may seem a bit hard to understand at first. What does having an accessible life mean if you're blind? Well, it probably wouldn't come as any surprise that people who are blind need and want access to the same things out of life that people who are sighted want. We need access to information, education, transportation, vocation, and most importantly, human connections. Those are just a few of the things. But if you stop and think about it, people who are blind have a bit harder time accessing these things, or at least have to go about accessing them a bit differently. For example, most of the information that you take in, you take it in visually. Of course, you hear things and you smell things, but a lot of what we take in as a sighted world is visual. Same with education. Even in 2012, you know, we have our smart boards and our PowerPoints and our handouts and our blackboards and our pencils and papers, and it's all visual. When we think about transportation, you know, we drive ourselves around, we use our vision to locate the bus stop or the train station or the cafeteria. When we think about employment, most sighted employers assume that they will hire someone who can see. That's probably the reason that the popular statistic says that around 70% of people who are blind are unemployed or underemployed. So, when you really stop to think about these things, even in the most important one that I mentioned, at least the most important one to me, in making human connections, making relationships, how do you do it without eye contact? How do you meet that cute guy at the party? You know, how do you start that relationship? Many, many things have to fall in place for a blind person to have an accessible life. I only have time to discuss two broad categories of them with you this morning. One of them is family, and the other one may surprise you a bit, but it's accessible microprocessor-based technology. Speaking for me personally, both my family of origin and my current family have been critical in my being able to form a healthy self-concept, in my being able to have a belief that I am good enough, that my disability doesn't make me broken. It doesn't make me weak. It doesn't make me any less wholehearted or worthy than a person who doesn't have a disability. And the reason that this is so critically important, a very excellent researcher from the University of Houston named Brené Brown, who researches vulnerability, has demonstrated that unless people feel wholehearted, Unless people feel that they are enough, that they are adequate, they cannot be vulnerable, which means you can't live your life to the fullest. I was born in 1956, very premature. I got too much oxygen in an incubator, which damaged my optic nerve, resulting in total blindness. It also probably saved my life. So I started out from day one, hour one, learning about the give and take that we know as life. So, interestingly enough, if you were born with a disability, a severe one, like blindness is considered by most, back in the 1950s and 60s, it was pretty typical for your family to, at the very least, overprotect you, to sort of keep you hidden away in the home, and to send you off to a state school for the blind when you got to be kindergarten age. My parents, who were working class parents, my father was a construction worker. My mom, after I was born, was a stay-at-home mom, but she had worked in the public prior to my birth. My parents did none of those things because my parents do the things that they feel are best based on their own inner compass, based on their own beliefs and intuitions. So it so happens that I had parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles who from the very beginning took me everywhere and involved me in everything. Yes, sometimes it was a bit stressful. I remember when I was 3 or 4 and my mom had me ride an elephant at the circus because she wanted me to know what elephants were like. So when my sister, who has no disabilities, learned to ride bicycles, roller skate, water ski, horseback ride, all those things, so did I. There was no differentiation made there because of my disability. They sent me to public school. I was one of the first people to be mainstreamed into public school in North Carolina. I spent most of the day in a regular classroom, but I met with a resource teacher for an hour a day who taught me Braille and taught me to touch type. And back then, the only way I had to turn my assignments in to my teachers, because they didn't know Braille, was to type them on a typewriter. That was great for output, but I was not able to read what I typed. So that was quite a problem. I finished high school and attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill for college. Like all freshman parents, my parents took me up to Chapel Hill and helped me unpack, said, "We'll see you later," and went home. I suddenly realized, I don't even know where the food is. I don't know where the classrooms are. I have no clue how I'm going to manage this. But because I had been given the foundation, because I had the self-esteem, the self-confidence, the general belief that I was worthy, and because I knew that it wasn't allowed in my family to quit, I put an ad in the newspaper, hired a bunch of students who needed a job to help me get around campus, to read for me, to help me find the way to my classes, to the cafeteria, so forth and so on. I made it work. I became a small businessman within a 2-day period in Chapel Hill. It was quite an odd thing, but it worked. So I went on through college and finished at UNC, got a BA in English, went to Western Carolina University where I got a master's degree in counseling. I worked there for about 5 years. Also met Vicky while I was there. We've been together for the last 30 years. She and I went to the University of Florida together where I began a PhD program in psychology in 1983. And I finished that PhD in 1989, came here to A&M because there was a job available. Never imagined myself living in Texas, but hey, why not? Came here and took a job with A&M and have been here for the last 23 years. Now, I could not have done this without the background that I had from my family, because one of the things that I learned from my family of origin was that you have to advocate for yourself if you have a disability. I remember hearing my phone, I remember hearing my mom one day on the phone talking to the school board saying, if those books are not available in Braille by August 1st, I will be calling the governor's office. Now that's advocacy. That's saying what you need and being assertive about it and doing what you have to do to make it happen. And that's what's required if you happen to be a person who is blind. But you have to learn to do that for yourself. Something very, very interesting started happening when I was a sophomore in college around 1975. The microprocessor-based technologies began to come on the market. People began to use pocket calculators in their statistics classes and to do calculations. Bye-bye, slide rule, hello, calculator, right? That's what happened around that time. Unfortunately, a calculator isn't accessible to a blind person because it has a visual display that displays the information that's on the screen. If you can't see it, you can't use it. So a company in California invented a calculator called the Speech Plus calculator, which spoke the buttons as you press them and spoke the answer to the equation when you press the equals key. Great thing to have. I used it throughout my statistics classes. Problem with it, instead of the $50 that you would pay for a regular calculator, this one cost $500. So 10 times the price. Next year, 1976, a man named Ray Kurzweil invented a machine that could read for people who are blind. You put a printed page on a glass scanner, it scans the information, processes the image, and then speaks the text of the page. Fabulous, because what are we talking about here? We need access to information. Most of our information is printed. Wasn't always that way. Before the printing press, we had an oral tradition, but blind people lost out when the printing press came along. So nonetheless, Ray Kurzweil did something about it, invented a reading machine. Fabulous. Only $50,000 for the first version of the reading machine. So it was only affordable by universities and industry. We had one, though, at the university, both universities that I attended, and I learned a lot about that machine. I wrote articles about it. I was very excited about the technology. Why? Because I saw it as being a way of leveling the information access playing field. Later on, a device came out similar to the one that I'm using right now, but it was a Braille device. For the first time ever, we could do word processing in Braille because it was done on an electronic display. This was very, very exciting because before that, you could stamp out Braille on a piece of paper, but once you had embossed it or stamped it into the page, punched it into the page, you couldn't change it. It was there. You know, you couldn't edit, you couldn't insert, you couldn't delete, you couldn't cut, you couldn't paste. But if you did Braille electronically, you can do all those things because it's on a refreshable Braille display. Sorry, I don't have time to explain more details of how these things work, but if you care and you want to know, talk to me during coffee hour. In the early 1980s, the Apple II computer came along, and we discovered that we could plug a card into the Apple II, and we could load some software that some people, some very talented people, had written, and we could make the Apple II speak the information that was on the screen. A talking computer, a talking word processor, a talking telecommunications device. Hey, I was on CompuServe shopping way before the internet came along. Pretty cool, huh? Early 1980s. Because I saw that this technology could level the playing field. Unfortunately, something happened that was really, really heartbreaking in 1984. Apple came out with its Apple Macintosh. Guess what? A graphical user interface, icons on the screen, a mouse that you pointed and clicked things at. How useful is that to a blind person? Not very. So most all of us switched from the Apple around that time to IBM and clone computers. Remember them? We had MS-DOS. It was a command line interface, perfectly accessible. Then Windows came along for the PCs. Fortunately, these little companies that I was talking about earlier that were inventing this accessible technology found a way to create what we called Windows screen readers that could speak the information on Windows screens, that could speak the state of checkboxes, radio buttons, and things like that. Fabulous. Main problem being that to retrofit a computer with a Windows screen reader would cost oftentimes double or triple the price of the original computer. About that time, Vicki and I decided we can either afford access technology or we can afford children, but we can't afford both. Fortunately, we found a way to afford both, and I have to be honest and say that I love my technology, but I love my son and my wife even more. So this went on for 21 years. And in 2005, Sleeping Beauty, i.e. Apple, woke up. And Steve Jobs announced at his, what they call the WWDC, the Worldwide Developers Conference, which is a conference for people who develop Apple software. He announced that the decision had been made at Apple to make Apple products accessible to everyone, including people who are blind. So what Apple did was they invented a screen reading technology called VoiceOver. And VoiceOver is a technology that allows a blind person not only to access the Apple Macintosh, but also the iPhone, the iPod, the iPad, and the Apple TV. And guess what? They don't charge a penny extra for it. It's built into everyone. Most people don't realize that your iPhone, your iPad, your Apple TV is accessible, that it can speak the information that's on the screen, but it can. Every one of them. And in fact, if you buy a Macintosh and you take it home and you turn it on and you don't touch the keyboard or the mouse for about 10 minutes, the computer will assume this person must need help. They must not be able to see what's on the screen. I'll start talking to them and I'll walk them through the tutorial that's necessary to set up your computer, even if you can't see the screen. So Apple came along and did something that was unheard of. They turned this accessibility paradigm on its head. They built the technology in to be accessible from the ground up into the operating system. So what this meant was that these technology companies who had been charging a lot of money for their retrofitted accessibility were now going to have to rethink their model, at least to some extent. There's still room for retrofitted accessibility. Not everyone wants or needs or likes Apple products, so it can't be the only game in town. But this principle is called universal design, and it's a very exciting idea because we first started seeing universal design in things like wheelchair ramps, curb cuts. Guess what? They're great for people in wheelchairs, but they're also great for moms with strollers or for people who have trouble getting up steps, things like that. They're great for everyone. And so this is the direction that we need to head, in my opinion, in our world of technology is universal design. Unfortunately, most companies are still just starting to get it or are lagging pretty far behind where Apple is. It's interesting that Google is now beginning to make its Android operating system accessible. They've got a ways to go to catch up with where Apple is with accessibility, but they're working on it. Amazon, big disappointment. They made their first early Kindle, they now call the Kindle Keyboard or the Kindle 3, somewhat accessible, but limited accessibility. It'll read a book to you, at least if it's a book that they've allowed the text-to-speech to be turned on for. It'll read a book to you, but you can't do things like move around by sentence or paragraph, or you can't easily have it repeat something, or there's no way to highlight or bookmark something. So they sort of made a little step, but then they came out with their Kindle Fire and their Kindle Paperwhite with no accessibility whatsoever. So Amazon has a ways to go to get on board with universal design. Just a couple of examples that maybe will be a little more salient to you all. This weekend, Thanksgiving weekend here, we have really been enjoying the benefits of universal design at our local Cinemark theater. You might, if you think about it for a second, think about, you know, that when a blind person goes to a movie at the theater, you miss a whole lot if you're not watching the screen, because so much of what a movie is visual. And Cinemark has introduced a system that when you go to the theater now, you can ask for a pair of headphones that you plug into a little box, and you sit down at your seat, and when the movie starts, you hear the audio of the movie in one ear, but in the other ear, you hear a person describing what's on the screen. So the movie studios have started building video description, or video narration, they're calling it now, into the movies. It's a fabulous thing. We saw Lincoln. We saw Life of Pi, which is a very visual movie, but with the video description, I was perfectly able to follow it and enjoy it. We saw The Sessions yesterday, all three with descriptive. In fact, virtually all the movies at our local Cinemark theater offer this video narration option. It's very exciting. It's nice to see this kind of thing coming along in universal design, being built in from the ground up when these movies are created. Ford, Cadillac, and Toyota have announced that in 2017, they will have self-driving cars on the road. This is huge for someone who's blind. I'll be 61 years old. I ain't too old to drive. I am very much looking forward to this new era of transportation where our vehicles will take us where it is we need to go. And again, it's universal design. It's not specifically just for people who are blind, but it's for all of us. You know, these cars are going to be able to drive within an inch of each other without an accident, and they're going to be able to go 150 miles an hour. And on the same roads that we have now, because they're going to be so much more efficient and so much more capable than we as mere humans are when it comes to driving, that they're going to be able to make up for the increased population, and they're going to be able to handle the increased traffic flow. And so it is indeed a very exciting time. And we don't know how it will go in terms of universal design yet. It's still in its infancy in many ways. I would love to see universal design come to all of our appliances in our home. You know, all of these appliances, our ovens, our washing machines, everything now have touch screens and now require vision to operate them. We need to build in some sort of accessibility. We need to make things accessible from the ground up. That's what universal design is all about. And that's why I combine this rather odd combination of, for me, as a blind person, the key to living an accessible life has been what I got from my family and my friends, what I still get from my family, and what I'm able to do because of microprocessor-based technology. I thank you for listening to me, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And if you care to learn more about this technology, I do a podcast called the Tech Doctor Podcast, and it's available on iTunes or at dr-carter.com, which is the website, where we discuss especially Apple technology and the advances that are being made and the changes that are being done. We discuss those things at great length. Probably wouldn't be of interest to most of you, but if you know someone who it might be of interest to, the Tech Doctor Podcast is a current resource that's out there. Anyway, thank you so very much. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll turn things back over to Katie.